everyone, it's Bina 007 here for the next chapter of Vassals of Kingsgraves, Agatha Christie linear reread. And today it is another mini pod. There's a lot of these because we're in the 50s and this isn't some of Agatha Christie's most memorable work. We are covering Destination Unknown in our 46th episode. This was originally published in November 1954. And it is a thriller. It is a Cold War thriller that very much speaks to its time. I would argue that it's unfairly overlooked. I think people can find its plotting a little bit laughable and incredible. But I think if you want to see Agatha channeling the news stories and the neuroses of her time, Destination Unknown really deserves a look. The novel opens in Morocco, where Hilary Craven, our protagonist, is staying after a failed marriage. She plans to commit suicide, but is instead recruited by the British Secret Service for a mission. She is asked to impersonate the wife of a nuclear scientist who has recently disappeared and is soon transported to meet her new husband. So this is a story that I think, for those of you who've watched Oppenheimer, speaks to the era of the atomic age, of great scientific breakthroughs, and huge Cold War competition for the loyalties of scientists. You saw in that film that Oppie, the hero, comes under question by the American authorities as to his true loyalties because he's suspected of having been a communist, or certainly fraternizing with communists in the run-up to World War II. His brother was a card-carrying communist. And because they know that people have infiltrated Los Alamos, Klaus Fuchs, who had come via Britain, had indeed been taking secrets, atomic secrets, and giving them to the Russians. And then, of course, you have the background of the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, under Senator Joseph McCarthy, interrogating not just scientists, as you see in Oppenheimer, but also people in the creative arts. Everyone came under suspicion of being a secret communist. This is the era of the Iron Curtain, of East-West competition. And as much as Agatha Christie has told us so much about changes in post-war Britain in her prior novels, I think this is a really interesting one that comes as a complementary novel to tell us what ordinary people would have been concerned about in foreign policy. So the scientist in question, who's done a runner and defected, we think, is based originally in the story at Harwell, which is still a life science park in the UK. It's also where the fighter pilots for the Battle of Britain set out. So it's a very historic and storied site. I think this is the first novel of Agatha Christie's where we see phrases like witch hunts and fission and the Iron Curtain and HUAC. So it's important in that respect. I think it's also the first novel where prostitutes are just called prostitutes without sort of being alluded to. So maybe in her mid-60s, Agatha Christie has had enough of subtle hints. Okay, so let's get into the events of the time. The prior novel to this is A Pocket Full of Rye, which was published in November 1953. As I said, Destination Unknown was published in 1954. Another Christie for Christmas. Apparently, according to the wonderful podcast All About the Dame, which I strongly recommend you listen to, there was some concern by the publishers that she wouldn't get out a novel in 1954, which if so would have been the first time that was the case in some years, because since 1921, she has literally published at least one novel per year, and in her hot period in the 1930s, sometimes two or three or four a year. So maybe again a sign that she's slowing down a little bit, justifiably, in her old age. So what are the events that would have been in the backdrop of readers receiving this incredibly topical novel? Well, in January 1954, the Soviet Union ceased to demand war reparations from West Germany. In February 1954, after authorizing 385 million over the 400 million already budgeted for military aid to Vietnam, President Eisenhower warns against his country's intervention. So the Cold War is really hot in those dividing zones between East and West. In 1954, February, also the transfer of Crimea. The Soviet Politburo of the Soviet Union orders the transfer of the Crimean Oblast from Russia to Ukraine. My goodness, how that remains topical. Also, Nasser becomes president of Egypt. So we're gearing up to the Suez Crisis here. In March of 1954, and my goodness, this must have been so topical when she was writing this book, US officials announced that a hydrogen bomb test has been conducted on Bikini Atoll in the Pacific Ocean. And again, incredibly topical for this book, American journalists Edward Morrow and Fred Friendly produce a 30-minute See It Now documentary entitled A Report on Senator Joseph McCarthy. So the McCarthy witch hunts are in full flight right now. Also in March of that year, Finland and Germany officially end their state of war. And also in that month, Viet Minh forces under General Vo Nguyen begin a massive artillery bombardment on the French military, beginning the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the climactic battle of the First Indo-Chinese War. And apologies if I've muddled those pronunciations. April 1954, in lighter tone, Kurosawa's Seven Samurai is released in Japan. Iconic film, holds up today. May 1954, again a very seminal and notorious moment in the civil rights movement, Brown versus the Board of Education is decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, ruling unanimously that segregated schools are unconstitutional. In June 1954, English cryptanalyst, mathematician and computer scientist Alan Turing, age 41, commits suicide by cyanide poisoning. And actually, quite recently, the British government apologised formally to him and his family for having hounded him for his homosexuality, one of the great tragedies of this time and our age. Also in June 54, another step in the civil rights movement, Sarah Mae Fleming is expelled from a bus in South Carolina for sitting in a white-only section. We also have in this month the world's first atomic power station opening at Obninsk near Moscow. July 1954, food rationing in Great Britain finally ends with the lifting of restrictions on the sale and purchase of meat, 14 years after it began in World War II and nearly a decade after the war's end. My word. So hopefully now no more mention of this in Agatha Christie novels. Also in that month, we have the Miracle of Bern, where West Germany beats Hungary 3-2 to win the Football World Cup. We have the release of Elvis Presley's first single, a cover of That's All Right. And for those of us who are huge Tolkien fans, as I am, in July 1954, The Fellowship of the Ring is published in London. August 1954, the First Indochina War ends, with the Vietnam People's Army in North Vietnam, the Vietnamese National Army in South Vietnam, the Kingdom of Cambodia in Cambodia, and the Kingdom of Laos in Laos, emerging victorious against the colonial French army. September 1954, William Golding's allegorical dystopian novel Lord of the Flies is published, and The Tonight Show first airs on live TV and NBC, becoming the first late-night talk show. And then in 1954, November, the month of the novel's publication, the first Godzilla film premieres in Tokyo, obviously hugely allegorical to the atomic bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The main immigration port of entry, New York Harbor at Ellis Island, closes permanently. And a little financial news, we don't often do that here. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rises 3.27 points, closing at an all-time high of 382.74. Ironic given that it's also brushing all-time highs now. More significantly, this is the first time the Dow has surpassed its peak level, reached just before the Wall Street crash of 1929. So again, that took basically 25, 26 years to claw back its losses. So what do I take from all of that? It's a time of Cold War, but also hot war. It's a time of great scientific advances and huge atomic power, but also of deep, deep mistrust in the West of communist infiltration. So against that, we have the plot of Destination Unknown. And typically at this point, I say, don't worry, listener, this is going to be spoiler-free to the end credits music. But actually, this is just going to be spoiler-filled lightly all the way through because it's not a conventional murder mystery. And I think the discussion will just be more fruitful that way. So if you have not read the novel, please turn away now. Although I don't think, unlike normal Agatha Christie's, I don't think it will ruin it if you know how it ends before you start reading, if that makes sense. So as I say before, the book opens with our attention on Hilary Craven, who has travelled to Morocco and is suicidal. This is how she describes herself later to Mr. Jessop. My husband, whom I loved, left me, and my only child died very painfully of meningitis. I've no near friends or relations. I've no vocation, no art or craft or work that I love doing. So this is a very sensitive portrait of a suicidal woman who is bereft, whose heart has been broken both by marital infidelity and the death of a child. And as Agatha Christie depicts this woman wandering around Morocco, going from pharmacy to pharmacy, building up a stash of sleeping pills so that she can commit suicide, it's one of the most acutely insightful and sympathetic portraits I've seen of depression in literature, and one that almost inevitably we have to assume draws on Agatha Christie's own experiences after being cheated on by her husband and ultimately going into a fugue state. And I think the character of Hilary Craven stands in great contrast to the female characters who are often the protagonists of these thriller novels. Whether the man in the brown suit or they came from Baghdad, they're often these young, bright young things, right? Who are pretty and vivacious and adventurous and don't mind lying a little bit, and they're up for adventure and they see a handsome man and off they go traveling the world, and they're kind of creators of their own destiny. They jump at chances. That's not Hilary Craven. Hilary Craven is decidedly middle-aged. She's quite passive in a way and very even-tempered, very wise in her years. And I think it's much more easy to see if those young girls were maybe a facsimile of Agatha Christie as she wanted to be in her early 20s, that this is more Agatha Christie as she was in her early 40s after that horrible marital breakup. So Hilary Craven ends up arriving in Morocco, but there is a vicious plane crash in which one of her fellow travellers, who is also a redhead, they're both very similar redheads, called Olive Betterton, this passenger dies. She is then, Hilary Craven, is then recruited by Jessop, who is a British Secret Service agent, to take up the place of Olive Betterton. And it transpires that Olive is the second wife of a scientist called Thomas Betterton, who has recently defected to, one presumes, somewhere behind the Iron Curtain, and that Olive Betterton is travelling to meet him. The British Secret Service want to find out where Thomas Betterton is, so they want Hilary Craven to take her place and be picked up by whatever courier route is in place and taken to his location. Because it isn't just Thomas Betterton that's disappeared, it's all manner of top scientists from around the world who have been vanishing. So there's basically a very, I think, really well-written, actually, travelogue in which Hilary Craven travels from different city to different city. So Marrakesh, Fez, these are all places that we see through her eyes. And these are places that Agatha Christie had visited. So they are very accurately drawn and really fascinating, I think. And she is picked up on her route by someone who comes across as a very sort of efficient, confident American traveler. And she's put on this route with a group of other scientists as they are being taken to their destination unknown. And amongst these scientists, they are of different countries and scientific specialities, but they also seem to have completely different and rather conflicting motives. So one is a very idealistic communist. Another is a straight out and out fascist. Another seems to be obsessed with sort of the Nordic race and slave nations. It just feels to Hilary Craven's wonderful common sense mind that how can they all be united in this goal? And at that point, she really does think that maybe they're going to be taken and flown to behind the Iron Curtain somewhere. But in fact, they are being taken by road and plane to the Atlas Mountains in Morocco to a secret research laboratory that is disguised with an actual leper colony on top of it. So I guess there's no way to hide in plain sight better than have a leper colony, because people are going to give you a very wide berth. And when you get into this secret lair, it just contains everything you could ever want to live and do great research. It's got laboratories, it's lavishly funded, and there is a limited opportunity to bring in your wives. And they only bring in the wives of the scientists aren't doing their work properly and seem distracted, which is why Olive Betterton was being brought into Thomas Betterton. Now, there's a moment of danger here, isn't there? Because Hilary Craven, when confronted with Thomas Betterton, what is to stop him just saying, "That's not my wife"? And it's fascinating because at that moment of meeting, it really is very stressful. Like, you feel the tension in the novel. And we get a spanner thrown in the works, because actually Thomas Betterton pretends that this really is his wife, Olive, and whispers in her ear, you know, "Don't say anything, there's probably microphones everywhere." And we realise that Thomas Betterton is really depressed. He has been unable to produce good scientific work in this very glorified prison. He's lost all of his will to live, and he looks like he's on the edge of a nervous breakdown. Meanwhile, Hilary is being taken to experience all that this hidden evil lair has to offer, including apparently haute couture for the women and prostitutes for the men who don't have wives. Of course, she's stuck there, right? So how is she going to get rescued? Or how is Thomas going to get rescued? And I suppose if this were one of the younger Agatha Christie heroine stories, like Man in the Brown Suit or They Came to Baghdad, the heroine herself would be an architect of escape. And that's what we saw in Baghdad, right? Where the heroine manages to be almost like a James Bond hero and escape. But actually what happens here is we realise in retrospect that Hillary has been dropping her pearls from her broken pearl necklace as pre-arranged with Jessop, which allows him to pick up her trail. And then through other means that Jessop arranges a very high-powered group of people to go to the leper colony, the kind of the front for this evil lair, and to expose what's going on there and unmask who did it. I don't have to reveal that, but I think it's pretty obvious in the novel. Like, I don't think it's meant to be some big secret that you unmask. I think what is maybe more of a secret that can be unmasked is the relationship of the final words that Olive Betterton spoke to Hillary Craven and the meaning that they have for the husband. And I won't say more because I think it will spoil the one bit of detection that you can do in this novel. What I think the novel is really about, however, is not detection. I think it's a beautifully penned portrait of a woman who goes from thinking that life has no meaning and almost being willing to sacrifice her life for the British Secret Service as a more useful form of suicide, to a woman who has more and more assurance in her own views and her own common sense and finds a reason to live again. And I think that's a wonderful thing, especially when we know how Agatha Christie has moved through her life. I think it's also a novel where Agatha Christie is stating very clearly her political views, which she doesn't often do. And she reminds me a little bit of that great Oxford political theorist, Isaiah Berlin, who was also prolific at this time. Isaiah Berlin, partly for his own reasoning and logic and partly because of his historical experience, really mistrusted big, grand utopian ideology. He mistrusted communism. He mistrusted fascism. He mistrusted any big worked out scheme that seemed to be impersonal and inhumane and put the collective before the individual. He was a classic liberal of the very best sort who thought that individuals mattered in all their beautiful diversity and frailty. And I think that's a little bit how Agatha Christie feels. This is Thomas Bettison describing what he was trying to get away from in scientific research in the West and what he has discovered in the evil lair. And I think in what he faced in the West, you can think of Oppenheimer being snooped on at Los Alamos, and being held in that interrogation that we saw in the film. So I think this is very real, actually. Quote, "You'll see for yourself, or perhaps it is that, more or less. But it's not the way you thought it would be. It's not freedom." He sat down beside her, frowning to himself. "That's what got me down at home, you know. The feeling of being watched and spied upon. All the security precautions. Having to account for one's actions, for one's friends. All necessary, I dare say, but it gets you down in the end. And so when someone comes along with a proposition, well, you listen. It all sounds fine." He gave a short laugh. "And one ends up here," Hillary said slowly. "You mean you've come to exactly the same circumstances as those from which you tried to escape? You're being watched and spied upon in just the same way or worse?" So what's interesting here is when they say the feeling of being watched or spied upon, having to account for one's actions, for one's friends. I mean, that's what happens to Oppenheimer in the film, right? He has to account for his friendship with Harkin Chevalier, who was an avowed communist. So I think the motivation of these scientists, whether the unscrupulous fascism, the distasteful fascism, whether the communism and the idealism, which we saw so clearly evidenced in the Cambridge Spies and in Klaus Fuchs, whether that simple wanting to get away from constant surveillance that Oppenheimer must have felt, these motivations seem incredibly credible, even though the kind of the plot architecture of this book is fantastical. The character of Hillary, the character of Thomas Betterton, seemed to me very grounded, very real, and very compelling. But let's now contrast this with how Hillary Craven feels about all these idealists and great, in quotes, men who have come to be scientists in this evil lair. Quote, "Why do you decry the world we live in? There are good people in it. Isn't a muddle a better breeding ground for kindliness and individuality than a world order that's imposed? A world order that may be right today and wrong tomorrow? I would rather have a world of kindly, faulty human beings than a world of superior robots who've said goodbye to pity and understanding and sympathy, end quote. And I think that's one of the most moving passages in all of Agatha Christie. I think it probably does sum up how she feels when confronted with a world in which big ideologies battling against each other, whether capitalism, communism, fascism, that she wants to foreground individuality and frailty and kindliness. And I think there's something to be really applauded in that. I think it would have had a lot of sympathy with J.R.R. Tolkien and his thinking, and I certainly have a lot of sympathy with it. And it's a quality that I find incredibly compelling in Hilary Craven, and it's why, even though she's not one of the Agatha Christie bright young things that I love, I think it's one of the reasons why I really do like this book. And I think it's not that it holds up today, because it's obviously an outlandish, almost James Bond plot, but I think it's an important Agatha Christie to read today, because it tells us so much about the time in which she was writing, and it tells us so much about her own values, and having lived through World War II and living through these great ideological clashes of the Cold War, where she positions herself in that moral debate. And there, my friends, I will draw this podcast to a close. There are no adaptations to discuss. It has never been adapted, which is a bit of a shame. Is the book progressive, regressive? Does it hold up to modern readers? The only thing to criticize, but it is a serious one, not to criticize Christie, I think this is of its time, but it's a bit jarring for a modern reader, is that at some point Hilary Craven has an ally inside the evil lair, and he disguises himself as one of the Moroccan servants. And in doing so, he puts on blackface and injects paraffin into his lips to give him, and Agatha uses the N-word as an adjective, lips. And that's jarring to read in a book that otherwise is actually very, holds up well for modern readers. So, Destination Unknown, a very overlooked Christie. I think this is actually, in some ways, better than a lot of her murder mysteries of the 1950s, because it's tackling profound topical subjects. I can see why it was really popular when it was published, and I guess its reputation has slipped ever since, because it speaks so clearly to the time in which she was writing, and I feel should not be overlooked by modern readers. But if you agree or disagree with my take, please feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube channel. Join us on our Discord server for our discussion of Agatha Christie there. Otherwise, join us next time for episode 47, which will be Hickory Dickory Dock, a more conventional Hercule Poirot mystery. Thank you for listening. ¶¶